Hello everyone, this is Nono Martinez Alonso and this is the Getting Simple podcast. In today's episode, I bring you an interview with the co-creator of Processing, Ben Fry. We recorded this episode at Fathom Information Design in Boston, Massachusetts on August 8th, 2018. I had a lot of fun hearing about the beginnings of Processing and Fathom, and I really hope you do as well. Before we begin, I'd like to remind you that you can find a detailed list of episode notes for this episode at gettingsimple.com/13. You'll find a list to a lot of the things that we mention in this episode, like typefaces, books, movies, companies, programs, or other things that Ben mentions, and a list of links to the people we mention as well. Also, there's a list of chapters I've added to the episode that you can both see in that link or also follow along in your favorite podcast app. These markers appear in applications like Apple Podcasts or Overcast and allow you to jump in between different parts of the podcast by theme. If you're listening to this episode, I would love to hear about it. So please reach out directly to me on Twitter at getting_simple or on Facebook, Instagram, or Patreon at Getting Simple. In Getting Simple, I look for ways in which you can be more productive and creative while enjoying a slower, more balanced life by deconstructing the lives of artists, researchers, engineers, designers, and other professionals from many different fields. Without further ado, I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode. Enjoy. Welcome to the Getting Simple podcast. Getting Simple is about simplifying your life and doing less better. I want to introduce you today to Ben Fry.
Hi.
Many of you might know who he is already. I'm going to try to find out some more about you, like beyond processing and design by numbers and Fathom. I think there is a lot of things that you do that are really of interest to me, like how you, in your practice or even in the project, how you framed the approach to design and how that affects a lot of more stuff in our lives. And yeah, I've dig down a bit of you and I just want to give a brief introduction. Ben here went to Carnegie Mellon University for undergrad, has a background in graphic design as his major and then a minor in computer science. And then, I know you're not from Pittsburgh, that'll come later. At Media Lab, you did a master's degree and then a PhD at the ACG group, so Aesthetics and Computation group. That, if I'm not wrong, that's been kind of dissolved, right?
It actually finished really the year before I wrapped up, and John started a new group and then stuck around for a couple more years. But.
And after that, you did Processing, so co-founded Processing with Casey, which is, for those of you who don't know it, we'll probably talk a bit about that. It's a highly enabling programming tool for non-programmers. It's been used by artists and designers and a lot of other people, different realms. And Daniel Schiffman was also involved in this project at a later date. Ben also worked at different places. I saw the name Netscape. That was
In between undergrad and going to grad school, I went and worked at Netscape, and it started blowing up or imploding.
You've also been visiting lecture at Harvard, done postdoctoral associate job at Broad Institute, so you've done some work with them, and a bunch of other stuff here.
Sure, yeah.
In 2010, founded Fathom, information design, where we are right now, and you've also been teaching at MIT. Okay, so is there anything else that I left out that we can say?
No, there's plenty to cover there.
How would you describe the city where you're coming from, where you grew up?
And the city that I grew up in, or Boston and Cambridge?
The city you grew up in.
City I grew up in. a liberal oasis in the heart of Michigan.
Ypsilanti? That's how
you... Well, yeah, Ann Arbor. I guess Ypsilanti is a little bit different, but it's, originally from Ann Arbor, but spent most of my time in Ypsilanti until high school. So, but it's sort of a, because the University of Michigan is there, it's kind of a funny contrast from some other parts of Michigan or what other folks have necessarily heard about Michigan. So not far from Cambridge, I guess.
So Ben also has multiple awards, some of them related to some of his data visualization pieces and have been exhibited in like MoMA or like a Whitney Museum or even the Hewitt Museum. Mm-hmm. I'll link to the list of books that he's published related, some also related to data visualization and to processing. And I would start having you talking about processing, like whether you imagine that this project that you started in 2001 would be something you were still involved in almost 20 years afterwards.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think we would have expected it. I think my expectation was always that we would do it for a little bit. For a little while, and if it was successful, that would still mean it was kind of around for a couple of years, and then somebody else would kind of come along with a replacement, and so there would be something else to do in place of processing. That it wasn't, you know, because we weren't trying to build a, you know, thing that was set up to last for, you know, many years, or we weren't trying to. Kind of make the ultimate, you know, tool for this, doing this kind of work. But really, it was kind of it was built around a collection of, here are things that, you know, that are an intersection between making things easier for just our own work and like be able to sketch things quickly and work through different ideas and code. And then the connection between that and teaching and like the kind of things that you wanted to do teaching wise. So, I think the funny thing has been that instead of there being something that's replaced it, instead that, you know, the projects have all kind of gone in lots of different directions. And so there are different kinds of, things where, I don't know, you've got, Arduino and Open Frameworks and, this new one, Open Render. There's, you know, just all these different, you know, things that none of them are really like a one-to-one correspondence or aren't really remotely a one-to-one correspondence to what we're doing, but just kind of set it, you know, take a different set of goals and a different kind of approach to the particular problem. You know, they carve off a different kind of piece of the problem. And so, you know, in one sense, it's really, I really enjoy seeing that and sort of seeing how that the field has evolved, because, you know, there really weren't other tools like this at the time we started processing. And so I think, so that development is nice to see, but I think there's also some part of me that's is surprised about the fact that like, oh wait, there isn't actually a replacement that kind of gives us license to say, all right, we're done. You know, we can move on, you know, that there isn't a different tool that I'm ready to use that's been created by somebody else that will help me create the kind of work that I want to create, or that is, you know, more effective than, you know, say processing for certain kinds of work at least.
I'm curious about how processing started and if it was one among many other side projects you had, or was a full-on project that you said, this is the bet take.
Yeah, it's always been a side. It was always a side project. There were a number of different threads. Like, I think the, you know, most formally, it's things like, you know, there was a culture around building, you know, libraries to get our work done, because there weren't really very good tools or frameworks or libraries to be used. And so that was just something that was in place at the Media Lab, you know, that prior to us, doing processing, we did a library called ACU. Prior to doing ACU, we did another one called AC Worlds. prior to that, we had one called AC Windows, and that was just within the aesthetics and computation group. And, you know, but there were, you know, when I first started, there was a library done by Dave Small that, you know, we used to kind of build C++ and OpenGL apps. But, you know, so that's like kind of, you know, late 90s kind of, you know, thing. But that dates back even into like mid and early 90s with like Bob Sabiston doing this thing called Bad Windows, which was like his own, you know, library for doing or framework for building the work that he was doing at the Visible Language Workshop, which was the predecessor to the ACG. And so, yeah, so there's always just that kind of, there was that built-in, you know, kind of culture around it. And then the other part of it was we kept, you know, just in our personal work, we would build small kind of mini frameworks for things, you know, so working on Design by Numbers, we needed some stuff for the graphics engine there, or working on my own projects, building small, you know, APIs that helped make it a little bit easier to, you know, kind of create some of the kinds of shapes and elements and things that I wanted to get to have it readily available. Or also things like, you know, I want to get all the pixels out of an image and start doing things with that image data. Like that was just something that required, you know, half a page of code to do it. And that's kind of silly. And so basically taking all of the stuff, you know, all of that as a backdrop, and then basically saying, you know, with well, Casey and I had been working on, you know, sort of the teaching and maintaining Design by Numbers. And so we learned so much about kind of how people used it and what they wanted to do with it, and you know, where it was deficient, or things that would actually make sense to add, or where people got tripped up in terms of learning coding. And and given that experience, we said, you know what, this also looks like we can actually, you know, can we actually build an environment that feels as immediate and, you know, simple as DBN does, where I can sit down and write a line or two of code and hit run and it just goes. But also behind that have something that's much more performant, like, you know, like Java in this case, so that I can rapidly, you know, kind of sketch with code, that I'm not kind of limited by, oh, it's a sort of this toy language that I that I'm using to build things.
What was the role of John Maeda
in processing?
Well, in Design by Numbers and then processing.
Yeah, so Design by Numbers was, you know, John's project that he he was just finishing the book when I joined the ACG, and you know, I think he wrote the first version of the language, and then Tom White rewrote it, and then I wrote two subsequent versions of it. And so really it was kind of like a lot of the inspiration came from there, or just sort of that whole idea of write a little bit of code and hit run, you know. Design by Numbers was a big pull for that, and also just the experience of working through it. But by and large, John didn't actually want us working on processing. That it was so this is, you know, back to your earlier question about, you know, like it was always kind of a side project because it wasn't our research, you know. And so Casey and I had, you know, talked about it a bit over one summer, and I started building, you know, sort of prototyping it a bit during Casey's last summer at the Media Lab. And then he left to go teach at Avrea, and I stuck around to do my, you know, PhD, and we kept, you know, but we kept kind of hacking away on it, but it was always kind of this separate, you know, sort of side project. And John wasn't really interested in us pursuing that because it wasn't a huge challenge for us, you know, as far as like, it wasn't a rethinking a way of doing creative coding, or actually it wasn't even called creative coding at that point, but it wasn't sort of rethinking the way that you learn to code and build things visually. It was very much this sort of evolutionary step. He didn't, you know, he was kind of like, I know you guys can build this sort of thing. So, you know, that for him wasn't very interesting as a research endeavor. And we weren't really interested in kind of making a new language for its own sake, or making something that, you know, that we wanted something very pragmatic that we could get people up and running with it. And that, you know, worst comes to worst, they know a little bit of Java and Java syntax. And hey, that actually translates nicely to JavaScript and ActionScript and, you know, these other kinds of languages. So it's not kind of, you know, time wasted doing our sort of pet, I don't know, pet environment or pet model for, you know, how to do a text-based language or, you know, something like that. So
your doctorate work was on computational information design?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was, my actual doctoral work was about, you know, doing information design and visualization, and basically how do you, you know, so starting with my master's, it was about sort of how do you, you know, what does it mean when you mix graphic design and computer science, like in the same context? And so with that, and how do you, you know, what is it, what sort of things does that actually enable, and how you, you know, kind of work with information with having the background of computer science there, so that you're not kind of limited by, you know, your level of patience with what you can lay out in Adobe Illustrator or InDesign or something like that. And so just, you know, the graduate work was about, you know, kind of working through some of those things. And then for my PhD work, it was really focused on trying to take those ideas and in particular apply them to genetic data. And, you know, the Human Genome Project, the draft version became available in June of, you know, summer of 2000. And that was right when I was making the transition from finishing my master's and starting the PhD. And so this seemed like something that was, would be, you know, interesting and compelling enough to kind of keep me going for 4 years of a, you know, PhD, and give me a nice domain to, that was both a massively complicated problem. It was very timely, but also our understanding of kind of what it meant, you know, our understanding, sort of popular understanding of what it meant to actually have the human genome decoded and understandable and whatever, was way out of sync with what we actually understood about it. And, you know, kind of, it was something where, you know, science was kind of a ways ahead of popular culture. And then somewhere in between there is, you know, policy and politics and, you know, sort of how do you think about this data? But also, like, there was so much to do on the science side as well, as far as, you know, just learning about the genome. It just kind of gave you this, I don't know, it gives you, you know, each new finding in science kind of opens up 10 new things that you don't know, or 100 new things that you don't know. And so it was one of those kinds of moments where there's just this real discontinuity between what people understand, how it's understood in popular culture, what it looks like, how do you actually, you know, break that data down for a science audience or a non-science audience. And so it just was a really interesting domain to look at.
Was Casey looking at the same problems?
No, Casey finished in summer of 2001, and he his master's work was really around like kinetic sculpture and you know, building various you know, machines that were kind of could react and form in space, and kind of taking some, you know, some of the two-dimensional work he'd been doing on screen and kind of making that into a much more, you know, much more physical and three-dimensional kind of thing.
So Daniel Schiffman.
Yeah.
So what was his involvement, or how did it happen?
Yeah, so we've had a, you know, over the years, we've had different people kind of, you know, help out in various ways. You know, Dan was teaching processing at NYU. And so, I don't know, I can't even remember how we first, you know, were in touch with him, but, you know, probably like doing a talk or something, or running into him at a conference, or he invited us down to, or one of us or both of us down to NYU. Also doing things like, you know, hosting events for us to, you know, kind of get together, like, so Casey and I have never lived in the same city while working on processing. And so, yeah, so like we only get together maybe, I don't know, once a year, two or three times a year, kind of depending. So like sometimes folks will, you know, so Dan's done a couple of events like for us at NYU where it's kind of an excuse to like come in and maybe do a talk or just, you know, hang out there for the weekend and work with, you know, Casey and folks like Andreas and Dan and others and just kind of get informal input and feedback and things about where we should take stuff. And just Dan was more, you know, more and more involved with that over the years, and is just such a great, great guy, and just has such a valuable perspective on this stuff too. As far as, you know, especially on the teaching side of things, that he teaches so many, you know, students how to get started with this stuff, and so that's a just an enormous, you know, just a really wonderful set of input that we can get as far as testing kind of what we've seen in our own classes versus, you know, what he's been doing, even at a larger scale sometimes with, just a whole range of students at ITP. So, but it's been great. It's just, you know, it's a whole extra level of energy to things that, and he's a good counterpoint to Casey and I, that I think Casey and I are both, you know, have a tendency to want to just kind of, you know, think it through and grind it out and all that. And Dan occasionally will kind of pop in and say like, if it's not fun, don't do it. Don't, you know, like just, you know, don't worry about that feature. Don't worry about this, or that's not, you know, that's not as much of a priority. And so helps us kind of keep things from getting too stuck.
Well, I saw one of your talks from way back, and I found this Valence visualization. Mm-hmm. Oh. I see it also, it can be you can call it visualization or piece of art, or mm-hmm. Valence is one of your projects that is kind of a different way to read a book or to analyze or mm-hmm. to see how it evolves in time as mm-hmm. you pass the pages, but in a different way. What's really interesting is I made it to Minority Report mm-hmm. or to The Hulk, I think, also.
Yeah, movie. There's a version of it that's using genetic data that's in the Hulk.
And in one of your writings, I've seen that you kind of say to yourself, like, I'm not a futurist. And yeah. In some way, that made me ask myself, is like, what is futurists? Like, are you, because in some way you have invented that visualization that then determined what they envisioned as the future?
Yeah, I mean, So that one, I thought it was funny since the, you know, so it's something that existed. I mean, it was, probably January of 1999 that I created it. And that the real, you know, the core of it was, I want to kind of design a system where there are a set of rules about how, you know, how things are laid out. And then I'm going to keep feeding data into the system, and I want to see how the elements inside of that system move around and rearrange themselves over time, because, you know, sort of a fixed set of data isn't that interesting. Most information is, you know, continually undergoing change. And so how do you represent that, and how do you build representations that can actually withstand change over time and be balanced systems that sort of you're designing with a time element in mind and designing with a, you know, change of input in mind. And as a designer, you're just, what you have to do is you're kind of setting up the incubator sort of space around this. And I guess part of the funny thing for that was, so it was something that was done and finished and, you know, in as of 1999. And then, but it's like, oh, this is something that's visually striking. And so they had it on, running on Tom Cruise's computer when he comes back to the to his apartment in one scene, and it, you know, and that's, you know, that's supposed to be 2054, and so like I always kind of it sort of cracks me up because it's like this idea of this thing that already exists, but it's like, oh, he's going home, and it's like now just kind of standard built-in, you know, sort of feature there in Windows 2054, and he's like using it to read his email or, you know, whatever. And I think the thing that I find fascinating for that is the cues that we take from, you know, just for films in general, that the cues we take from films that start guiding our expectation of how the world should work or things that are possible or can be done. Like, I saw a really wonderful exhibition once, maybe like the Air and Space Museum or something like that. But it was basically, the whole exhibition was about the influence of sci-fi, or maybe it was even like specifically Star Wars and Star Trek. And it showed lots of different, you know, things that have been developed over the years at NASA in particular, and that, but also interspersed with all of the, all these researchers and scientists talking about like, yeah, so I saw Star Wars, or I saw, you know, this particular thing in Star Trek, and I wanted to go build that. And so like I went and, you know, had this career, and I've been, you know, chasing after that thing that I saw as a kid. Cause I was like, well, that's cool. We need one of those. Or that you have this expectation of, well, that's just how things should work. And so therefore, that's your baseline for how, you know, interfaces should behave. Like, I mean, even like Big Hero 6, which is like a kid's animation movie, like, the way that the researchers interact with things is all entirely gesture-based, and all, you know, that they have these really wonderful fluid systems for building very sophisticated engineered artifacts. And so I just picture these, like, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-olds watching that and being like, well, yeah, okay, that makes sense. This is how these things should behave. And like, if they don't behave like that, or they don't, those systems don't work like that in the intervening, you know, 10 years before they're actually building those things themselves, they're going to be like, they're going to be pissed, and then they're going to try and build it themselves. And, but just, I find it interesting just how those, you know, kinds of influences work. I don't think that's, I don't think the, that particular case of Valence and Minority Report is one of those where it's like, this is a changing the world kind of way of looking at things. At least not in the way. So, you know, my friend John Underkoffler, who did the gesture interface stuff for it. And, you know, that's really been a touch point for people as far as, or a reference point for people, that they, you know, anytime you have an interface that kind of works like that, people say, oh, like Minority Report, you know, and that's, you know, a real credit to him, because he was just doing such groundbreaking work. You know, and that was coming from the work that he'd done at the Media Lab. A funny counterpoint, though, too, is, you know, so a different variant of that Valence project that was, you know, based on working with the genome or genomic data was in the Hulk. And in the Hulk, it was like something that actually worked, you know. So the way that the thing that it did was it actually showed how basically how searches of the genome work, you know. So like, if you're searching genetic data, there's this really fascinating system by which, you know, that you're looking for these, you know, sequences of ACGT letters, but you can't look for exact matches because there might be, you know, single letter changes or something like that. And so the visualization became, you know, or was then modified to be about that, and sort of an explanation of how that worked, but also to, you know, look interesting. And but even though that was a working, you know, art piece, tool, installation, whatever at the time, the Hulk was set in sort of set in present day, they had to add extra interface and UI elements around it so that it looked like it was real. You know, so even though this was a real thing, it was using real data, you could do real searches on it, actually implemented the algorithm, you like it. They had to roll it back down to, you know, what people's expectation of what an interface, you know, looked like. And that, so John, who had done the Minority Report stuff, he was also the one who worked on the Hulk and had to have this whole, like, you know, kind of argument with the director, you know, that he's like, oh, this is real, you know, real data tool being used. You know, scientists are aware of this. This is how this stuff goes. And he's like, no, this is like too sci-fi, too weird. We're not doing, this isn't a sci-fi movie. It's, you know, like, it needs to be more present day. And so just this interesting conversation of like, well, what's that actually mean, and what, and also the, you know, again, going to the expectations thing, that having to kind of dial back the interface. So adding a lot of gray and scroll bars and, you know, text and things like that around it, so that it felt more like a, people's expectation of what an interface looked like. So
Microsoft Word, or
yeah, right. More, let's Microsoft Word it up. So.
So you have a post about not needing approval to publish mm-hmm. something. And I mean, we've seen, I just wanted to hear your opinion on how you, I guess you could do the same thing today, like release process in the same way, mm-hmm. but how did the open source community, how was in that epoch? How did you manage to distribute the application, and how would it be different today?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the post is about, you know, kind of with the advent of the App Store and Apple having guidelines and rules about kind of what can go in the App Store, and that everything has to go through the store and everything has to, you know, meet with their approval, and, you know, really a set of criteria that are quite arbitrary. It's really not a good, it's not a good model, and it's not a... it's really problematic for doing new things or things that don't, you know, fit under the mold of what people expect out of it. And it's really quite counter to, you know, certainly what Apple, what's made Apple successful in the past has been third parties doing really interesting things in their platform that stretched it in different ways that made, that really added to it. And nowadays, Apple is, you know, kind of the opposite of that, where they kind of set up a, you know, really lovely kind of walled garden kind of thing. And, but they, you know, restrict people to kind of working within that set of constraints. And I think it's really problematic. I think it's really kind of set back, software and software development, quite a bit, because I think the things that are, you know, our innovations happen, that there just isn't much innovation on the, on those platforms. And that, I think we'd be in a much more interesting place. Like the stuff that you can do with like a, you know, a phone or a tablet is really, really pretty amazing. As you know, just sort of a device, you know, like when I was, say when I was writing the Valence piece, it's like, that's 1999 and I was working on an SGI Octane and it cost $25,000. And even like the cheapest iPhone can actually run that software now, you know, like it's, and run it faster than it ran on that original SGI Octane. And so the idea that we have, you know, suddenly we have this amazing amount of, you know, IO and devices and, you know, all the things that that platform can do, but instead we're kind of, you know, things need to fit into like a bucket of a utility, or, you know, this is a game. And really the store has been kind of overrun by games, and it's kind of, you know, a small number of people and companies who are making the vast majority of the money. And, but for me, I, my whole career has really been about being able to, you know, create whatever I want and not really have to ask permission, you know, to kind of work within a platform. I mean, part of the reason I mean, over in the genetics domain, part of the reason I was able to get into genetics was people were, you know, worked very aggressively to release the human genome data because they wanted to kind of get out ahead of people trying to, you know, patent parts of it or something like that. And so, yeah, so it's a frustrating state of affairs, as far as I think it sets back what you can really do on the platform. And I think you have to, if you want to say work for, build something for Apple's platform, you have to use their tools. You know, Apple over the years has not been traditionally a very good maker of, you know, tools and development environments. It's usually been sort of third parties who have done much more compelling stuff for the first, you know, few decades of Apple's existence. And so, you know, it's neat the places they've been able to take the platform, but like, I can't help but think about what would it be like if there were third party tools. And, I wish I could support that as a platform. You know, I'd like to build more things that were more, you know, iOS centric or specifically Android centric or whatever, but it's really kind of a bad choice to have to make as far as, well, you can do this iOS stuff, but you're completely walled in, or you can do Android, which is kind of like the Wild West. And, you know, they're kind of closing things down a bit, but it's still, you know, sort of problematic with it in its own, you know, sort of direction. And Apple's kind of built a community of people who are willing, you know, more willing to pay for the, you know, the software and tools, but they've also kind of destroyed the pricing for what, you know, what those tools are and so forth. So it's just kind of disappointing to see. Like, I think Apple really had a turning point sometime around when Jobs returned, where the Apple that I grew up with was really about, you know, sort of this amazing enabler of, you know, what you could do in the platform. Like, if you read the Apple II manual or the original Mac, any original Mac documentation, it's about welcoming people in. It's about speaking clearly. It's about, you know, being very readable and plain and straightforward, and about kind of, hey, look, here are all these possibilities for, you know, for this platform. And as a result, people did really interesting things with those platforms. And they've really become, you know, that if you read the documentation now, it's like the first several paragraphs are about, or the first paragraph is always, aren't you lucky to be here? You're using the most beautiful device and the most amazing framework you've ever, you know, it's ultra, I don't know, just, it's, but it's like marketing copy instead of, you know, it's about Apple and it's about marketing. It's not about the people who are using it, and it's not about, you know, it being an enabler. It's just sort of this, you know, well, you're lucky to be here and enjoy.
I completely agree. I have a bittersweet feeling as well, because sometimes you get, as you say, you get locked down into a platform. You kind of get to really like the frameworks they have, mm-hmm. and the way of working and how sandboxes everything. And I mean, it feels like it's really performant and it works and it's kind of beautiful or things like that. But then you say, wait a minute, I'm investing all these resources, all this time in doing this that only people who have an iPad are going to be able to run. And I can rewrite the whole thing in P5 and put it online or processing and distribute it over different. And it's just like, sometimes it feels a bit too much that they have this kind of closedness.
Yeah. And it's, and it's just, you know, so for a long time, well, I mean, processing has always supported, you know, Windows, Mac, and Linux from the outset. And that, you know, because we often, because we think it's important to be cross-platform, and also that we'll often, well, in everyday use, we work with multiple platforms, you know, that we have Windows machines and Linux machines and Macs here. You know, the most of, the majority of the machines might be Macs, but it doesn't mean we can't, you know, we don't need to work well with this other stuff. And so it just, it's very, and also that we've done maybe four or five apps with the App Store, and every single time it's been an incredibly negative experience, as far as we've never had something accepted on the first go. And the, you know, the rejection stuff tends to be very arbitrary, or, I mean, I had to have a whole discussion with somebody about, like, I don't know, you know, is it functional enough? And what's the, you know, and that they're like, well, I mean, I guess it is, what, you know, it is nicely designed. So, I mean, maybe it's okay. It's like, I don't care about your opinion. Like, the people downloading this can make that decision. Like, you, I don't need you to approve my design or what I've done here, or, you know, give me this sort of, I don't, yeah, it's just, it's, and so as a result, like, and sometimes that's really problematic. Like, we had a project that we were trying to get launched for a client, and Apple held it up in review for 6 weeks, you know. So we had several rounds of, you know, going back and forth with them, dealing with paperwork and submission problems and whatever, and that just arbitrary things about, like, oh, when you rotate the iPad, if you start it up upside down, it needs to respond this way. And it's like, what? You know, like, we're doing this for a client. And so this, but the, you know, the point there being, these are arbitrary things, and you, as somebody who's running a business, I can't build a business around somebody who, you know, somebody who's a gatekeeper about like, yeah, I don't, you know, I don't like that app, so I'm not, we're not going to approve it because, well, it kind of sort of violates this rule or that rule, or I'm having a bad day, or, you know, whatever. So,
so one topic I would like to hear about from you is that, as I mean, I always think of José Luis as building his own tools, mm-hmm. and other people like in architectural field, in graphic design, or even myself, build your own tools mm-hmm. To then use them. So yeah. thinking, yep. I need this thing that I have in mind that might make my life easier, or in the case of processing, the life of a lot of other designers and artists. What I think is really valuable is that you have built this design firm or business which relies on a fairly amount, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for some things, I don't know mm-hmm. up to what extent, but mm-hmm. it's really powerful that you're on involved in the development of a tool that it's actually actively used by you. Mm-hmm. How does that play?
Yeah, so I even thought you were going to get into kind of the people making tools for themselves, that we should talk about that too. That, but as far as for me, that I think one of the main things for processing was always, you know, Casey and I wanted something that we could use for our own work, and it wouldn't be very interesting, or I don't think you can really make it a very effective tool if you don't care about it and use it yourself. And so everything that, you know, so a lot of the decisions that go into it are based on experience with, well, nearly all of the decisions are based on actual experience of either teaching people how to do this stuff, or trying to simplify something that we found frustrating or, you know, difficult to do, or, you know, felt like it should just be more accessible and easier to get at. So there's that, but there's also like this idea of people who are creators building their own tools that actually support their work, you know? So the, like the name processing comes from this idea, like it's sort of a play between the idea of process, you know, so this idea that it's not necessarily an ends, but more of a means. And we get excited about people who integrate, you know, processing as one piece in a much larger design process. And then also processing as far as, you know, computers are processing machines and so forth. But this idea of building your own tools that help you get your own work done, I think is really very powerful and really important. You know, so like José Luis being a good example there, where, you know, like I'm less, in some ways that's some of the work that I get most excited about, is like seeing people who kind of use processing as a way, as sort of a bridge to build something that then helps them create the thing that they'll eventually, or like make it easier to create the thing that's actually in their head, you know? And also this idea of, you know, one of the things I get excited about for people learning to code is, you know, it's that, especially people who are creating things themselves, it's that those are folks who are making decisions about, you know, the things they build based on the things that, you know, again, the things that are in their head and that they want to actually see or, you know, work with or touch in some way. And that's very different from, you know, tools that you purchase, which are designed by some combination of, you know, marketing and engineering, and what can be charged for, and what's, you know, what's going to be a useful feature for a lot of people, and a very, you know, sort of lowest common denominator kind of thing. And so a lot of times in terms of the way it applies to say something like processing is, I'm much more interested in, and this, you know, goes for Casey too, that we're more interested in somebody kind of building, you know, not a replacement for Photoshop, but building their own Photoshop, or building sort of that subset of, that subset of features that, and well, or just enough of it that makes it, useful for their work, but also extends in a way that, you know, does all these things that you can't do with Photoshop, but it still might be, you know, image oriented or something like that. And so just the idea of, you know, like having lots of these sort of, you know, smaller tools that are very practical for one's own work. And then sometimes those evolve further and become tools that are used by, you know, not just one person, but a few dozen people or a few hundred people, or, you know, maybe they get out of hand like processing did and, you know, get used by thousands of people. And that it's that just that much more, more interesting that way. But again, that it's, those are tools also, again, coming from people who are creating things themselves. And so they are focused on the creative process, not sort of a meeting a lowest common denominator for what can be sold to the largest possible audience.
Do you have any examples of a favorite app that you consume that somebody else develops and makes your life easier?
Within, like built with processing or just in general?
In general.
Oh, I don't know. Not off the top of my head.
What about if I tell you what's your favorite user interface?
I like, I'm really into like film user interfaces and like the campier the better usually, but like I really love sort of, you know, sort of there's the geeky part of, you know, them just being these funny sort of sci-fi things, or they're just like really corny or whatever. But also like the more intellectual part about it that I enjoy is the this expect, you know, seeing the expectations of what the way that people feel like an interface should behave. And so like we're like kind of like what we were talking about before, but just this thing of you know, people complain about kind of how computers work in movies, but there's so much of it that has that's grounded in like, well, why doesn't the computer just do that? Like, why isn't it just one button to do you know, this particular feature? And I mean, stripping away the sort of big blaring access denied screens, or, you know, uploading virus and Independence Day, or, you know, some of this other goofier stuff. But, you know, you look at, like all the, basically any interface that's in 2001, or, Alien has some really beautifully designed set design stuff, around it. You know, others, yeah, I mean, just, you can kind of go down the list. There's really wonderful stuff there.
But you mentioned 2001. Do you have any favorite typeface or family of typefaces?
There's a set of things that I tend towards for sure, like certain kinds of sans serifs and then certain kinds of serifs as well. And what we use, you know, for Fathom, we use Sentinel because it's a really wonderful sort of update of something like something older like Sentry, but has much, you know, sort of takes the nice aspects of that, but also modernizes it around the corners. And it's just a really elegant face with lots of different weights that are useful in different ways. And then, and that's, you know, we use that for the Fathom logotype. We use National as a sans serif, which is a nice kind of sans serif that's still a little bit friendly. We also recently have been looking at Fabrica, which is a really beautiful sans that we found works really really well for sort of a screen you know, certain kinds of screen interfaces. And Ringside is another one that we've been looking at a bit, that we are looking at as a potential replacement for National, as far as just sort of an elegant sans that just, you know, but isn't quite as plain as like the kind of overuse of Helvetica that seems to have taken over everyone's brains.
So what's the first thing that you look at for any design? So something both when you have to do it, so let's say you have a brief and you have to do it, and also when you see someone else's design and you kind of analyze it, what you look at?
I don't know. Like, I think when presented with a design problem, mostly I start digging into, like, I don't know, a lot of pictures kind of immediately come to mind about what, so we worked, you know, exclusively with data. So usually what happens is that a lot of pictures kind of come to mind about what what shape that data is and ways that it might be, that we might clearly explain what that shape is to other people and how to, you know, make sure that that's, that representation is something that's, that actually shows the side of the data that, or the aspects of the data that are most relevant and that are most kind of mapped into what, the way people need to use it or see it or think about it. And yeah, and I guess that, you know, sort of looking at other work, it's really kind of the inverse of that process that I'm trying to kind of unpack what decisions have been made to say, and try and map that back to the criteria with which people, the person in question, you know, created the particular piece. Cause I think it's just the context of these things is so important that, I think there's a lot of, design critique and, it's really unfortunate in information design and visualization where there's sort of, you know, a lot of the critique, you kind of take away all of the context and say, this is the right way to do this one, you know, this kind of design, or this is the right representation, or you should always use this and not that. And, you know, bar charts are better than pie charts and all these other sort of silly rules that have no bearing on anything, but maybe, you know, people kind of like to cling to as far as, I don't know, just kind of ways to make them feel smart or, you know, be exclusive about the field or something. You know, so it's always, and so it's trying to say, so in evaluating something, it's like, how do you look at what's there and think about, you know, the context that they're trying to reach and also the audience, you know, the context in which it's intended to be used and then the audience that they're trying to reach with it and sort of say, does this make sense for the people for whom this has been created? Or is this, you know, is it unclear or is it too much detail or not enough detail or is it true to the data in question, or is it actually hiding something, or is it just, you know, a lot of stuff just is kind of the first draft that you, you know, data is kind of pretty on its own. And so like, there's a lot of visualization stuff that's sort of took this data set and made a picture out of it. And that, and then that was it because they had a nice image and, but it wasn't really about, you know, sort of communicating something interesting or useful about the data. Just it's like, oh, this looks good. You know.
So to recap a bit, Ben is a founder of Faron Information Design, and paraphrasing their statement on their website, they build platforms and products for understanding data. And basically whoever hires them, they help them think about their information and not just display it, but like try to make it more meaningful to convey in different ways. I'm curious about if you guys here at the office have any magic rules of things that you usually do to make things easier to understand. I mean, there might be some rules of thumbs, like when you get certain piece of data.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of them, and we should probably be writing them down and talking about them more. The big thing is just that trying to, you know, that audience and context thing of like trying to establish that as early as possible as far, you know, the audience and context, and then also just what's interesting about the data. So, you know, like we did a piece recently with ProPublica, and it's, you know, about basically the, you know, spending at Trump properties, you know, so the Trump organization. So unlike all of the presidents since Nixon, you know, Trump didn't bother divesting his companies or his assets or anything like that, after coming into office. And so, you know, the Trump campaign then basically just spent millions of dollars at Trump hotels and using the, you know, paying themselves to use the Trump, airline, you know, sort of private airline to, you know, fly around. And so basically just took donations from, people who supported his campaign and just dump that right back into his companies and therefore his pocket. And, you know, so which it's perfectly legal. But then as soon as, he became the nominee, you know, the Republican National Committee started doing the same thing. And so, other campaigns, started donating, which is another level of just kind of like, that's a little weird. And then, But then in January, when he was post inauguration, then the U.S. government started doing that. So basically, if people wanted to hang out with Trump or have meetings with him or have proximity, they were that much more likely to spend taxpayer dollars at Trump properties. Anyway, and this is an ongoing and pervasive thing, and so it presents a lot of design challenges around, how do you build a visualization that kind of is a comparison against zero? It's not about how much money is being spent. It's the fact that any money is being spent at all. And so how do you, with that, it's like, given that kind of problem, we're trying to figure out how do we convey that, just the magnitude of what's happening versus, kind of saying, well, it's this many million or this many $100,000 in this thing, or, and that, because if you do that, people are immediately thinking about like, well, does that sound like a lot of money or not? Or, and it's like wrong thing, wrong question, that what you want to be thinking about is the fact that this is happening at all. And, in that particular representation, one of the things was, it's really about, the frequency of it and the ongoing nature of it. And so the final representation that we went with was about, sort of showing that frequency and showing how that was changing over time and how that was continuing and how it would continue to fill in over time as more data was added over time. And, but that's a different thing than just, hey, we're going to, sort of do bar charts that stack up how much money is being spent and, things like that. Like, how do you make something that's relatable in a way that conveys that sort of frequency aspect of it? And, hopefully helps make that broader point.
So I believe now the one of the biggest mediums for spreading what you create is in the internet. And before we had computer screens, now we have tablets, iPhones, mm-hmm. and there is still some print, but mm-hmm. that's not really it depends on where you are. How does that play in your information design? So mm-hmm. Does it make it easier to spread, but harder to?
Yeah, I mean, we're fairly output agnostic in the sense that we enjoy doing stuff for for phones or for phones or for screens or for large scale installations, or we love doing print stuff. That there are enough graphic designers in the office that we really geek out about print and printed things and, high density materials like that. And, we like to use print as, or I've often used print throughout my career as kind of a way of doing a first draft of something where I have a bunch of data that I'm working with that, sometimes it's nice to just print it all on a, nice high density sort of, poster and kind of get a look at things and get a sense of what you're actually dealing with and sort of the scale and scope of things. And so we still use it that way. And then also occasionally in between other projects, we might do, a poster here, a book or, something like that, just because we enjoy, sort of working with print. But also it's, if somebody wants us to do an AR project, we'll do an AR project or a VR project. Great. That it's just what we care about is that it's information and design centric, and everything else is just, a different medium to work in with different sets of constraints and a different, kind of going back to that audience and context thing. It's like a different, different kind of context in which you're creating the thing, and you make very different artifacts for those different contexts.
Which of your projects do you consider has been most influential or most well-known, viral?
Oh, I don't know. The most for Fathom?
Yes.
Let's see. Probably in sheer number of hits. We did a project about MacGyver once, and another time we did a project about Rocky. And I think just in pure number of, that's not true, because our China project got more. Those would be the biggest for sort of non-client projects, because those, got, I don't know, there's a lot of MacGyver fans on the internet, And same thing with Rocky, and that I hadn't even realized what a cult sort of, I knew what a cult the MacGyver stuff was, but didn't realize the extent of like how much people wanted to, like it was a comparison of the various movies and kind of the breakdown of what was in them. And man, people like to argue about which is the best Rocky movie. And I kind of wish we had actually made that. Had we known that going in, or had I known that going in, like we should have made that an element of the piece too, for people to kind of weigh in on what's best or worst or, you know, whatever. And in terms of client stuff, it's hard. It's really hard to say because the metrics on each are so different. You know, like we did a project about China that had 250,000 users in the first week, and then, you know, continue to have, you know, hundreds of thousands of users afterwards. We did stuff with the Clinton Foundation and Gates Foundation, and the, you know, Chelsea Clinton one morning was on one of the morning shows and like talked about the project, and the hits just went, you know, completely bonkers. And it's, you know, like we kind of forget like how incredibly influential TV is and like just how massive those, or at least I do. I don't know. I don't watch a lot of television. And so it's just kind of funny to see, you know, see how those play out.
Okay, I would like to change gears a bit and talk more about yourself.
Uh-oh.
So do you consider your life simple?
Not terribly simple. I think I'm still trying to do too many things at once, and so that's making for a point of complexity with things.
What things, if you can think of specifics, make your day more complex that maybe couldn't just be like that?
Just day to day at work, for instance, it's very much, we're at a dozen people, and so it requires me and everybody else to wear a lot of different hats at various times, and the context switching between over the course of the day today, I've done IT stuff like server setup. I've done sort of management stuff like working with staff on different things. Done sort of design direction things to go through, you know, sort of how to refine a particular piece. Things around product development to say, you know, for us to kind of prioritize what we, you know, features that we want to put in an upcoming product. Client development things around setting things up with a potential client, client management things about sort of modifying the scope on a current project, you know, so it's a lot of also just doing software development to support other things that are happening internally, or showing somebody else about how to do a particular coding thing to for a specific project. And so that's, it winds up being a lot of just context switching. So that can be, you know, that can be tricky.
Do you have any daily habits of less than half an hour or so that have an impact in your life?
I walk to and from work every day, which is a huge, huge thing for me, sort of just lifestyle wise. And it gives me a way to kind of wake up in the morning and also to wind back down in the evening. And it's, you know, mile and a half or 2 miles, and just do that kind of rain or shine. And usually I'll even like listen to a book or something like that, which is kind of great to be able to like just I can listen to books faster than I can read them. I'm a terrible reader, but great because I haven't been able to read nearly as much as I would like. And so just being able to, you know, get through a lot of stuff that way has been really fantastic.
Are there any other activities you enjoy outside of work time? That
most of my time outside work is spent with my family. That we have a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old. And so any time that I'm not working, I really need to be and helping out my bride, who's, you know, shouldering that all of the other hours of the day. And so, And so that's a lot of fun, but it's also, can be very tiring too.
If you do, how do you face boredom? If you do get bored, because you might not have time for that.
I really despise boredom, and I really like, I get really upset. Like, it's a really quite rare, that I feel bored about anything. And, I actually get really upset if I actually am feeling bored, because it's just like, that's so stupid. Like, it's, how can you possibly be bored about something? But usually I'm just exhausted and need to rest, or, you know, something like that. But, I don't know how I can be bored. There are too many things to do, and too much is interesting out there.
What's your relationship with social media?
It's weird. I kind of, I enjoy reading the news and understanding kind of what's happening out there, and what, you know, learning things about kind of how the world is functioning and working and all that. And, I have kind of a weird, I feel kind of weird about it, because it's like, I'll, you know, read Twitter because I want to, you know, kind of track the news and sort of see what's happening. But it's also like just kind of like this horrible cesspool too. And so I wish there were a better way of, you know, kind of having the positive aspects of, you know, what I like about that, and with fewer of the negative parts of the kind of herd mentality stuff and all the other problematic things that come along with it. Social media is important for us, as far as, people knowing what work we're doing and what we're up to, and our business is really, based on the inbound work that we get is, you know, really contingent on people and like even knowing that we exist. And so, so we have to make, you know, some amount of noise about that. And, I've never been comfortable with, you know, promotion and self-promotion and things like that, but it's also just kind of a pure necessity of, some element of that is, you know, has to be done in order to kind of, help support all the other things that we care about a lot more.
Just in case I forget afterwards, where can people find you online?
Fathom.info and benfry.com and processing.org.
Thank you. How do you disconnect from the internet and devices and communication?
Yeah, so I'd like to just shut down completely. And in particular, I like to go places with family that are detached from that, and I can, you know, sort of focus on people around me. But also, even like on a day-to-day basis, for instance, here at Fathom, we stop midday and have lunch together for an hour or so, and just as a group. And that is and we have a rule that you're not allowed to use your phone, and it's just sort of a, and we also don't talk about work during that time. And so it's kind of our midday, like kind of detach from everything and talk about other stuff and think about something else. And it was something that kind of started as a tradition, because very early on, we were working on a very difficult project, or a very difficult couple of projects that were really, you know, just kind of intense. And, you know, there were two or three of us, and we're just kind of cranking away. And then we needed to like stop and like reset, and before we got back to work. And so we just started doing that as a thing. And then that's just continued for the almost 9 years now that we've been around.
So how do you think that affects both you personally and also the work that you do here?
I just think it's good. Like, I prefer to be able to, instead of I'd rather be, you know, sort of focused and dialed in and getting things done, and then take a break from that, you know, to take a mental break from that, rather than just trying to grind out the entire day in as short a time as possible, you know, and like just sort of force yourself, eat through lunch, you know, eating at your desk is particularly vile. Like, you know, it's just, it's, your brain just can't, you know, can't work that way. And it's, and I think for me, it's, I work a lot of hours in the day, and so it's one way of just kind of keeping some sanity from that.
Is there any app that you on purpose don't install on your phone?
Don't install? No, nothing in particular.
So if I tell you, what's a healthy relationship with technology?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, I don't know, I probably shouldn't like think out loud about this, but I think it's something on the lines of being able to, you know, use it for how it makes things useful, things that are useful for you, but understand the ways that it's changing what you're doing and be fully aware of that. You know, like for any tool that you use, it's going to have an impact in the way that you think and the outcome of the thing that you're creating. And similar with any technology, that it's, I think if you spend too much time around technology or working within a too small a community of people who are just technologists, it's really easy to get kind of caught in a loop of what a normal relationship, or like what appears to be a normal relationship with technology, but isn't really normal. And so just, you know, being around other people who use technology in very different ways, or I think about spending time with, you know, family and extended family that they have such different relationships to the stuff. And, that's a helpful perspective on, you know, how you relate to these things, I think.
How do you think, advertisements online affect us?
I don't know. That's a big one.
It comes from, because I get the perception that we are opting in to get ads everywhere now, like promoted posts and things, and everyone seems to feel that they are not affected by them. It's a bit, I believe it's a bit of a naive thought.
I feel like we're on the edge of something giving way on ads, because I think the current model and just doesn't seem sustainable to me as far as what you have, like, it's just very, very weird to be tracked from site to site. And actually we were talking about this at lunch a little bit, today, that, you know, just this thing of going to one site and then visiting another completely to shop for something, and then visiting a completely unrelated site hours or even days later and having it pop up an ad for the thing that you were looking at once. And it's like, I don't want to buy that thing from that company anymore. And like, that's just so pervasively creepy. And I, you know, that's like an extreme case, but, a lot of it's done in very, you know, subtle ways. But also like our biggest companies, like, Google and Facebook. So Google, 93% of their revenue, I believe it is, comes from advertising. And, you know, I think the vast majority, if you were to ask 100 people who aren't in technology, like what Google does, they're like, oh, they do search. And it's like, no, they're just a big ad company. Like, they just sell ads. And so, you know, and similar with Facebook, what's gotten them into trouble is the fact that they're just kind of selling all the data about us for advertising. And basically their business model, and I think, you know, Twitter is the same way. Like, basically you can't take the what makes Facebook horrible out, or what makes Twitter horrible out of it, and still have a sustainable business model for them at remotely the scale that they're at. And so that's a highly problematic thing, because there are billions of dollars invested in, you know, like literally billions of dollars going to them finding ways to not, or convincing them not to change that model, you know, and that they're so far down that path that it's like, I don't know, Facebook can't really pull back. And I think, you know, the same thing happens with Twitter, that its CEOs, you know, saying particularly dumb things online, you know, today or yesterday about, you know, their willingness to ban people or whatever. And just this idea that, but basically they, I think what they know is if they, you know, ban people who are problematic and kind of clean up the place, they're not going to have the same levels of engagement and numbers. And, you know, that like the controversy keeps people clicking and coming back and being ragey. And, you know, at some point that's going to burn out, and we're going to have to read a lot of insufferable like pieces on Medium by, you know, Jack Dorsey of Twitter and others who are like, oh, we really screw this up and we should have done this or that or whatever. But it's like, whatever, they're rich, they're fine. You know, so it's just, it's an unsustainable thing. And I'm curious what will, it's interesting how it's come to the fore, whether through the Russian ads during the election or people getting kind of spooked about what Facebook does, or people talk, you know, getting kind of frustrated with Facebook, but then they're like, yeah, but they're still on Instagram. You know, it's like, same company, same, you know, same stuff.
We're getting pursued by police.
Yeah, the Mass General Hospital is across the street, obviously. And so it's, we get the ambulances from one side, or any police car heading to 93 is going to noisily go out that way. Or there's a fire station half a block down, so plenty of noise.
What would you define as success?
Saving the easy ones for last.
Or if you can name one successful person that comes to mind.
I don't know. I think it's something like being in a spot where you can, you know, for me, it's being in a spot where you can do work that you really enjoy, that it's challenging, and you're making you're creating things that you in turn and enjoy further with other people that whose company you know you appreciate and can learn from, and it's great to hang out with them, and that's something that moves along in a, you know, a positive positive way, and sort of a long, you know, as a long-term thing. And then separately, kind of, you know, personally having, making the time to, be with, you know, family and friends, and, you know, sort of establishing and maintaining those kinds of relationships outside of the work side of it that, yeah, that are that much more, you know, worthwhile, and provide that kind of, you know, support and happiness and whatnot. So everything else kind of comes out of, you know, out of that, whether it's other measures of success or, you know, whatever. But those are kind of the baseline things.
I think that was a great answer. So if you could send the message that the whole world would read in the morning, what would it say?
Oh, so there's a quote I love. It's probably my favorite, but it sums up so many things for me. That so the quote goes, "We act as though comfort and luxury were the chief requirements of life, but all we need is something to be enthusiastic about." And I think that's that speaks so nicely to this thing of, well, just about anything, you know, as far as the work that we do. It's not about, you know, having an easier work day. It's about doing things that you actually care about. Or it's, in terms of technology, it's not about gadgets that, you know, are sort of shave 10 seconds off of this and 30 seconds off of that and kind of make your life, you know, kind of easier in quotes, but kind of make it more complex and, you know, 10 other ways. You know, but just this thing of what, you know, the things that actually make us happy are tend to be kind of out of sync with the things we perceive to make us happy, or the things that we might create to, I don't know, that are shortcuts or whatever to being happier, I guess. But it kind of, you know, it kind of goes to that other stuff of, you know, the boredom thing, you know, like it's part of the, it's like, how can you be bored? You know, that how can you, there's just, you know, there are too many other things out there, to, you know, or to, places to visit, languages to learn, books to read, people to meet, you know, like it's just, there's, yeah, you'll never run out.
So do you have any book recommendations?
Let's see, two kind of related to, you know, work here that, are nice kind of overviews. One is called, and the stuff that we've been talking about, one is called The Information, and it's sort of like a pop science look at, sort of information theory over the years. And it's just a really wonderful kind of combo of history and science and pop culture and, you know, sort of blending that together. And then there's, I think that's James Glick. And, another is, called The Innovators. And I think it was, Walter Isaacson. And so, and the thing about it is that it's basically a history of computing, but kind of goes at this premise of, you know, a lot of the press, for instance, talking about, you know, technology is, it's sort of obsessed with, you know, sort of these, solo characters who, you know, are these geniuses that make everything happen. And it's like, well, yeah. And then they have like 30,000 employees behind them who are actually like kind of make all this stuff work. And I say him to subconsciously, but it's also kind of like, usually it's a him that's being deified in the press. But one of the nice things that it does in the book is that it kind of goes back, and that sort of the counter to that is, well, no, it's the institutions and structures and, you know, the environment in which these things happened that allowed different people to be successful. Or there was a, you know, there's always a much larger number of people or things that had been put in place, whether institutionally or policy wise or funding wise or whatever, that, you know, kind of made these things happen. And, but it's nice because the book takes a really even-handed look at kind of going back and forth between those two, and that instead of saying, oh, it's all these specific people, or, oh, no, it's the institutions, it's like, well, here's where a person kind of helped move these things along, but also here's the context in which they did those things that allowed them to do the work that they did, and here are the other people that were kind of behind that. And it just does a really wonderful job of kind of weaving that story together. And so, you know, but it's kind of it's probably the best, you know, I've always, since being very young, have been interested in this, in these fields, both design and engineering, computer science, and also have always been interested in the history of both. And, this is kind of one of the best takes that I've read of, you know, like as much of that material as I've consumed over time.
What would you do if you had a couple of weeks to work on a side project?
There's a specific side project that I've been wanting to do for many years, and we have somebody in this summer, and I've made him sort of start working on a bit so we can make some headway on it, because I'm sick of thinking about it, and I think people in the office are sick of hearing about it. So stay tuned.
And the last thing I'll ask you today, what's your take on simplicity, or what role do you think it should play in our lives?
On some level, I don't actually believe in simplicity. That I think there's kind of a lot of attention given to sort of simplicity or complexity, and that I think they're really it's entirely a perception thing, and it's just kind of two different sides or two different aspects of the same thing. And, you know, the things that we think of as being simple are often simple because of a lot of complexity underneath them, or the things that are complex because of a lot of simple elements that, you know, form together to do something that's very, very messy. And that, so, you know, like there's a even kind of a side comment in The Powers of Ten, where they talk about moving through the various, you know, orders of magnitude of distance, sort of this pattern going back and forth between very sparse and simple and very, you know, very complicated and active and, you know, very complex. And, but that's, you know, so there it is kind of playing out at the sort of, at these, you know, orders of magnitude of space. But you think about, you know, even so, like the room we're sitting in, it's like this is fairly, you know, fairly simple. There's not a ton of stuff on the walls. There's, you know, a table, some chairs, and a, you know, screen, and whatever. But it's like, but what, you know, what's that mean? We've got, so you and I are each made of 37 trillion cells. You're, you know, working on a computer that can operates at a, you know, clock cycle of, you know, three gigahertz, megahertz? What is it these days? You know, and just the, you know, phenomenal complexity that went into that, or to, you know, the engineering of that artifact, or the texture, you know, if you look at the wood here in this table under a microscope, and then the way the fibers hold together, and the things that they've done to make the wood flat and smooth enough to, you know, sort of work nicely as a table. And so it's just, or the, you know, panels in the wall, they're there for soundproofing to prevent the sound from just, you know, kind of bouncing all over this space. And so, yeah, it's really just a matter of kind of the level at which you're looking at things.
Okay, so we've reached the end. We made it. So the first thing I wanted to say is thanks a lot to you, Ben.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And thanks a lot for Follow Information Design for let us use the space. And thanks to Danielle and, like, I mean, a lot of amazing people work here. I can know Mark, Terry, Olivia, and Rachel, and a lot more. You can actually go and see that, see them on their website. So that's fathom.info again. And I would really, really recommend you to go, because they have amazing design sensibility. I really like the typeface they use. Their print work that you can buy on their shop is really cool. I actually got one of their maps from the US. And yeah, it's worth taking a look, because a lot of things are really informational, never better said. And they also have really good computational skills, so you can also get inspired to do your own projects, or maybe just take a peek. Anything else you want to say?
Oh, that's great. Thanks for the opportunity.
I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for this opportunity a lot. I really value your time. Like, I know how hard it is to schedule things these days.
It's great.
Thank you, everyone. I hope you enjoyed. Before you go, I'd like to remind you that you, the listener, are the reason why I make this podcast. If you want to keep up to date with new episode releases and writing, you should join my mailing list at gettingsimple.com/follow. You can find the whole list of episodes at gettingsimple.com/podcast. If you want to support the podcast, you can rate the podcast on the iTunes store, as this is the best way for other people to find about it. And if you want to support it financially, you can become a Patreon at patreon.com/gettingsimple. Now you can listen to the Getting Simple podcast not only on iTunes, but also on Spotify, Overcast, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, really. As I mentioned earlier, please reach out to me directly on Twitter at getting_simple, or on Facebook, Instagram, and Patreon at Getting Simple, and let me know what you think about this episode. Once again, I'm your host, Nono Martinez Alonso, and this is one more episode of the Getting Simple podcast, a podcast for you to find ways to be more productive and creative while enjoying a slower, balanced life. Have a simple week. Thank you so much, and see you on the next episode.